From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. National Public Radio is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we look back at the early days of the network and the early careers of the three hosts of All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer tells us about the first broadcast of the program, which she directed on May 3, 1971. Robert Siegel tells us how he learned about the power of misinformation. And Noah Adams tells us what it was like for a shy person to break into the news business. Also, pardon my French. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers why the word French is so often associated with sex. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations says the UN Special Envoy to Bosnia, Yusuf Akacsi, has not been replaced by peace mediator Thorvald Stoltenberg. Akacsi will continue in his duties, but Stoltenberg has been asked to take on additional duties in the Bosnian region. He's become a special envoy who will be asked to open negotiations in the Bosnian War and in the former Yugoslavia. Bosnian government officials aren't happy with either man and say they won't work with either of them. Stoltenberg's new duties come as the United Nations tries to decide what to do about Srebrenica. The town fell to Bosnian Serbs this week, who forced out some 40,000 Bosnians, mostly Muslims. During a Bastille Day news conference, French President Jacques Chirac lashed out at the United States and Britain. He told them to pull themselves together and join France in fighting against the Bosnian Serbs. Chirac said if the West doesn't act, France could pull out. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Using some of the most undiplomatic language that's been heard in France for years, President Jacques Chirac said Britain and the United States have no right to lecture others about democracy and human rights if they don't take military action in Bosnia. He said the fall of Srebrenica was reminiscent of the Munich Conference in 1938, when France and Britain gave in to Adolf Hitler. He said the United Nations had humiliated itself and was becoming an accomplice to ethnic cleansing by the Bosnian Serbs. He demanded that Sarajevo and the remaining Muslim enclaves be protected. Otherwise, he said, France would have to pull out. Chirac also warned the United States that if it decides to lift the arms embargo against the Bosnian government, that UN troops would have to be withdrawn immediately. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Triple-digit temperatures continue through parts of the Midwest and Central Plains today, pushing the death toll from the heat wave to at least 17. From Wisconsin Public Radio, Chuck Kornbach reports.
The medical examiner in Milwaukee says temperatures that have reached 100 degrees each of the last 2 days may have contributed to the deaths of 5 local residents. Several other heat-related fatalities have been reported in Chicago, Kansas City, and Iowa. The hot weather also continues to take its toll on animals, and a livestock plant near Humboldt, Iowa, reports the deaths of 200,000 chickens. Electric utilities are struggling to keep Midwesterners cool. A Milwaukee-based power company has had to shut down a nuclear generator because of an electrical problem. Some relief from the heat is in sight, as a weather front is starting to bring milder temperatures into parts of Minnesota. For National Public Radio, this is Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 22 points at 4,705. Trading is very heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the NASDAQ Composite Index is up almost 3 points at 996. This is NPR. An advisory panel to the Food and Drug Administration is okaying a radical experiment to try to save the life of a dying AIDS patient. The panel will permit the patient's doctor to give him a bone marrow transplant from a baboon. The FDA must still formally approve the experiment, but doctors and researchers say they hope to save the 37-year-old, or rather have the 37-year-old volunteer undergo the procedure. His doctor calls it a long shot. Part of the controversy includes exposing a human being to viruses carried by baboons. The Senate has made exceptions to the regulatory reform bill that it's considering. Toxic waste cleanup projects and federal standards for mammograms will be exempted. Opponents of the bill are pushing for more exemptions. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The bill requires risk assessment and cost-benefit analysis for new regulations with an economic impact of $100 million or more. Supporters say the regulatory burden is suffocating the private sector. Opponents argue the new requirements would make it easier for industry to block costly mandates that protect the environment and public health. A group of Democrats and moderate Republicans have tried repeatedly to modify the bill. Measures to exempt food safety regulations were rejected. Opponents also tried to change a part of the bill that eases the requirement on industry to list the toxic chemicals it releases, but they prevailed in exempting Superfund toxic waste cleanup projects and mammogram tests from the overall bill. Majority Leader Bob Dole says the efforts are unnecessary because his legislation makes exceptions for public health and environmental emergencies. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Here's a couple of economic reports out today. The Labor Department says consumer prices rose 0.1% in June, the smallest increase since last December. The small increase was led by a drop in clothing prices and moderate food costs. And retail sales jumped in June, led by strong demand for cars. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Jerry Gross. On this archive edition, we feature interviews with Linda Wertheimer, Robert Siegel, and Noah Adams, the hosts of All Things Considered. See if you recognize this.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Robert Conley with All Things Considered.
That's how All Things Considered began its very first broadcast on May 3, 1971. The host was Robert Conley. We'll hear a report from that broadcast a little later. My guest voice will be more familiar to you than Conley's. Linda Wertheimer has been hosting All Things Considered since 1989. She actually directed the first broadcast of the show. After helping to shape NPR for nearly 25 years, she's put some of its history between the covers of a book. It's called Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation as Heard on National Public Radio, and it features news stories, interviews, and commentaries. Before hosting All Things Considered, Linda was NPR's congressional and political correspondent. I asked her to share some memories of directing that first broadcast of All Things Considered.
Well, from my personal remembrance of it is of just being terrified. I was completely terrified. That the tape wouldn't get there, that everything that could go wrong would go wrong, that we wouldn't make the air, that there would be horrible big black holes in the middle of the program, none of which happened. But things were late and things were very rough, and they continued to be very rough for some time to come. But the first day, I came to work on a bus. There were beautiful flowers in Washington. It was a beautiful spring day, and there was so much tear gas in the air that you just choked on it because there were anti-war demonstrations in Washington. And it was a weekday demonstration to shut the Capitol down, to close the bridges and prevent the traffic from getting in and just completely mess up the capital city for the day. And that was the day we went on the air.
How did you cover what was happening in Washington?
Well, we sent reporters who, you know, untried, untested, unknown quantity type, quantity things. I mean, we of course, we knew them, and we had done pilots and so on. But it was, you know, this was the real thing. Reporters went racing out with tape recorders to try to get a real flavor of the day, to record lots of interviews, to record the sounds, to just speak into the tape recorders their reactions to what they were seeing and their descriptions of what they were seeing, to make it as immediate as possible. So that was the assignment. About six people hit the streets with tape recorders, going in all sorts of directions, and they brought it back. And then we tried to, to slash and cram it into the program.
A line of young people is just come across the highway. Traffic is stopped. And here come the police. One, two, three, four police on motor scooters. One demonstrator knocked down by a motor scooter policeman. Anger now. Anger of the young people. Here come more police. The demonstrators just told a motorcycle sergeant that one of his men did knock one of the demonstrators down.
All right, where? Let me get an ambulance down here for you. Motor 3 on the Southwest Freeway. Have one injured down here. Could you send me an ambulance, please? It's right at Main Avenue.
And he hit the kid. He went right through the line.
That guy passed me and almost knocked me down. And the blue...
Yeah, but it's a policeman we're talking about.
On a motorcycle.
Policeman.
On a motorcycle hit him. Not a citizen.
Right there. The man over there. Right there.
Sergeant, excuse me. Jeff Kamen, National Public Radio. Is that a technique where the men actually try to drive the bikes into the demonstrators?
No, it's no technique. We're trying to go down the road and the people...
How did listening back to this tape when you were editing the book compare to your memories of that day?
You know, what I remember of the day was the confusion and the fright that we wouldn't make it and concern about how it was going to sound and so on. But listening to it, what amazed me was that it's pretty good. You know, it's very rough and it's very it's confusing. But then so was the day confusing. You don't get a lot of details about names and times of day and that sort of thing. But what you do get is a very strong feeling about what it was like to be out there. Now, that's our stock in trade still. That's what we still try to do. And I think that when we succeed, you know, that's the best thing that we do, is just put you right into an event.
Linda Wertheimer is my guest, and as you know, she's a host of All Things Considered, and she's edited a new book called Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation, as heard on National Public Radio. And it includes highlights of 25 years of reports on NPR. I want to get to an interview of your own that you've included in the new book, Listening to America. This is an interview that you did in 1992 with Ross Perot. You did this interview because of something that you knew about from when you were covering the House Ways and Means Committee back in 1975.
Yes.
Tell us what you knew that you wanted to ask Ross Perot about.
Well, it was a story which was broken back in the 70s by the Wall Street Journal. During the course of a drafting of a tax bill, an amendment was added to the bill. It was a provision which enabled... It was a version of loss carryback. It essentially enabled a person or a small group of people who had large gains and large losses within a certain period of years to balance one against the other, to even out their tax burdens. You know, they'd get big deductions one year and have to pay very heavy taxes in another year to sort of average that out. Since it was designed to only hit a few taxpayers between a certain number of years, it was, you know, a so-called tall blonde man with one black shoe amendment, specially designed amendment. So everybody knew this had to be a favor for somebody. And the Wall Street Journal had the capacity to do the research. They just simply asked their research department, find me a taxpayer who has had huge gains in this period and then huge losses in this period. And... you know, do you have anybody that meets that criteria? And the computer came up, Ross Perot. So they broke the story that Ross Perot had caused to be inserted into a House bill an amendment which would have resulted in a multimillion-dollar tax refund for him.
So this is what you wanted to confront him with?
So, yes, because... on the theory that some people have personal problems that don't bear the light of day, and that various candidates were having various kinds of difficulties with things in their personal history. So what I asked him was, do you think that the kind of, you know, piratical, although entirely legal, activities of big business are going to be any more palatable to the voting public than some of these extraordinary, items in people's personal lives would be. So I just wanted to ask him about his business conduct, essentially.
Did you get a satisfactory answer?
Well, he got really mad. He basically lost his temper. And we put that on the air.
Let's hear what he said.
I assume this is the sole reason for your taped interview.
No.
And your classic setup. So now that you have, you know, whoever you're trying to do a favor for, you've done it. And I'm sure you had a smirk on your mouth as you got me into this. And now that since you misstated it totally, and I have given you the facts on it, What else would you like to know?
I would like to pursue it further, but let me just ask you...
What is your show, anyhow?
All Things Considered.
And is this a radio program?
It is. But let me ask
you... It's really a radio program. You're not just somebody calling in.
No, sir. No, sir.
Now, would you want to know more about it?
I'm just wondering if you think that business practices may be somewhat more difficult to explain than, say, personal behavior has been to explain for some other candidates.
I'm not going to worry about it for a minute, and I just assume that there will be days when people like you show up doing a favor for somebody, and you've done it.
Was there any debate after this interview about whether his comments to you, is this a real radio show, should be left in or edited out?
Well, my feeling was that when you're talking to somebody like Ross Perot, or like the President of the United States, or there is nothing to be gained by editing the tape, and much to be gained by just leaving the whole thing there. Of course, so we didn't touch it. We didn't edit it at all. And the fact that he, you know, sort of leaped to the attack rather than answer the question, I thought, you know, meant something. And so we left it completely entire. Now, that meant that we left in that silly-sounding giggle of mine, that sort of nervous laugh. The person who was producing it did cut that out, and I told him to put it back because I wanted to be able to look at Ross Perot right in the eye and say that's what you said, in case he came back to us and tried to claim that it didn't happen that way.
Linda Wertheimer is my guest, and she's edited a new book called Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation, as heard on National Public Radio. Linda, you grew up in New Mexico?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I started hearing you on NPR, I just assumed you were from New York. Your voice just said New York to me. Obviously, I'm incredibly wrong.
Well, my family, no one in my family had a strong, you know, Western or Southwestern accent. And I have no idea why that was, because they were all from the West and Southwest. My father was born and raised in Louisville, Texas, and my mother was born in a wonderful a town with a wonderful name of Loco, Oklahoma. And so we're Westerners for generations. But I went to Wellesley College, which I suppose, where they did think that I had an accent, although they thought it was mostly on funny words. I mean, I would say things like fixing to, meaning I'm about to. Or once I said striped. And I didn't say that again. But there were... I don't know. We don't talk very Southwestern, I think.
I know your father ran a grocery. Did you have to work in the store?
I did. I worked. I delivered groceries on Saturdays and worked in the store in the summertime. I grew up in a town called Carlsbad, New Mexico, which is famous for the Carlsbad Caverns. Well worth the trip if you're in the area, and it is. It's not a very big place, and there's nothing close to it. You know, it's not like living in Evanston and being close to Chicago. It's 150 miles to the next sizable city, El Paso. And between Carlsbad and El Paso, there's not much. So it was a very self-contained place and very peaceful and... When I delivered groceries, I would just walk into people's kitchens, and if nobody was there, I would put their groceries, I would put the, you know, ice cream in the freezer and milk in the refrigerator before I left. And the doors were never locked.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Linda Wertheimer, she's a host of All Things Considered. She edited the new book, Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation, as heard on National Public Radio. Our interview was recorded last April. We'll hear from Robert Siegel after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We're featuring the hosts of All Things Considered on this archive edition of Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has hosted the program since 1987. Before that, he oversaw the entire news operation as the director of NPR's News and Information Department. He also served as NPR's first London bureau chief. This is his 19th year with NPR. Now he's editing a series of annual books featuring the best of NPR's interviews. I spoke with him last November after the publication of the first volume, NPR Interviews 1994. He's currently at work on the 1995 volume. Our interview was recorded before a studio audience. He told us how he got started in journalism.
I became bitten by radio. I loved doing radio.
This was at Columbia University.
This was at Columbia College, Columbia University. And I would do newscasts, but I would be a golden oldies disc jockey, and I would announce classical music, and I just loved radio. And I was always doing news, and that was at least the activity that redeemed the other activities, made the others seem somewhat plausible that I should be wasting all this time at the radio station. And then at the end of college, I was doing news at the radio station, and the Columbia demonstrations, the big anti-war, anti-gym demonstrations they were really, of 1968 took place. And we covered them round the clock, and I anchored the coverage. And
did you sleep at the radio station overnight?
Yeah, we slept at the radio station. And I loved it. I was absolutely bitten by it. But I hadn't entered wanting to be a journalist.
I bet that was an interesting education in a way, because maybe it was different in New York, which has, the New York Times and the Village Voice. Where I went to school in Buffalo, we all felt when we were students, when there were demonstrations on campus, that the press always got it wrong. Their numbers were off. Their motivation was completely distorted. Was it an education for you to witnessed what happened and then read what the press had to say about it?
It was a very extensive education. First was the experience of saying something on the radio, and then an hour later seeing it come over on our one ticker, a now obsolete machine from the Associated Press, and then hearing our newscasters read it as though it was now news, when after 30 seconds of analysis, was this was what we had just said. It's now been disseminated by the Associated Press. The Columbia demonstrations were interesting also because first it showed me that when you live in a community, as I did in this university community, there are some things that were news and different. Like there were hundreds of students occupying buildings, and there was a threat of arrest, and they were about to be arrested by the police. And then there were things that were absolutely normal, like there were radical mime troops around the campus, or people wearing bizarre clothes, or posters. That was normal. And as the television people would arrive, they thought all that was part of the news story. they had difficulty distinguishing between what was unusual and what was everyday. And I realized that there are things you understand about a story by living in it and by being part of it, and then translating it to people. You're either talking to people who are part of it or talking to other people. The big lesson for journalism was the night that I think 700 some people were arrested at Columbia in what was to be regarded as a disastrous evening for the New York City Police Department, a loss of control, and many people were beaten. Some of them I saw being beaten. And the New York Times went to bed early and published a lead that said that hundreds of students were peaceably evicted from Columbia University's Hamilton Hall, which was actually true, but then the other events that had happened after the Times went to bed were never quite reported or made it into the very bottom graphs of later editions. And for a couple of years, I saw people who actually were pretty sensible human beings trying to say that there had been this mass indiscipline by the police, only to have the New York Times held up to them to say it didn't happen. Many young stringers for the New York Times and even young staff reporters threatened to quit over the over the coverage of that event. But I remember David Suskind. Remember David Suskind?
Of course.
I remember David Suskind's show where someone was trying to explain that there had been police brutality at Columbia, and he held up the New York Times, and there it was. And the power of of the press of record, people who establish the official version of events, to form people's opinions or to help them rationalize their opinions is enormous. And it made a deep impression on me.
Did you go to journalism school, or did you learn on the job by doing?
I went to the job, then I came back to journalism school. And
is that helpful?
Notorious dropout from the Graduate School of Journalism.
Not that helpful.
Well, it's helpful in some way. I met a wonderful man who was a mentor to me, the late John Patterson, who had been a great radio editor at CBS for many years, and a man who actually had lost his legs in the war in a troop train accident, and was a marvelous stoic Virginian from the Shenandoah Valley who could move enormous newsroom tables with one hand and a cane. But I also found it not what I'd become accustomed to in the way of university education. I thought it was a lot of it was awfully anecdotal, and I also just wasn't much of a student.
We're featuring an excerpt of an interview with Robert Siegel recorded last fall before a studio audience. One of the listeners asked Siegel if he could interview any public figure, who would it be?
Instantly, when you say public figure, I think about which leading politician I might want to interview. And those are so often the hardest and worst interviews that we do, that they're, I find them not attractive events. Most politicians I find are off on their own answers, and they have their agenda, and it doesn't matter what I say to them or what Lindor Noah says to them. They'll give the. Was I just saying? I can't remember what I've said and what place now. But did I mention Linda Wertheimer's proposal the other day? After each of us had recently done a prominent public figure who would have given the same answers if we had, regardless of what we'd said. And she said, I think in the future, Rob, I think we ought to ask these people. We should just say, have you seen the new exhibit at the East Wing of the National Gallery? Because just the same, they're going to say, the president has heard the message of the electorate. And then we should just come back and say, and what about the Redskins? Do you think they have a chance of doing that? And they'll still say, he's a man of the center. He began as a man of the center. So there are some interviews where, to be realistic about this, we're just not... We're furniture, frankly, in some of these interviews, and it's not a great ambition. Public figures. There are some writers. This year I got to interview V.S. Naipaul, the novelist, who may not mean much to a lot of people, but it was a big experience for me to talk to him. And it was in the sense of talking to a star. It ranked right up there with interviewing Stan Musial the other day this year. For me, the somewhat talented harmonica playing Hall of Fame baseball player, those to me are more satisfying interviews. And I guess if I could get an interview with the Pope, I would find that pretty interesting. In particular, having done some reporting from his hometown, and having been aware of. What I think is one of the central roles of the past 15 years of history that we've experienced that he's played.
Robert Siegel is a host of All Things Considered. He edited the book The NPR Interviews 1994 and is now at work on the 1995 volume. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our archive edition featuring interviews with the hosts of All Things Considered. We'll hear from Noah Adams. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers why the word French is so often attached to things that are sexy or naughty, as in French kiss and pardon my French. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A controversial FBI official has been removed from his job. Deputy Director Larry Potts has been moved from the Bureau's number 2 post because of his role in a deadly 1992 standoff in Ohio. FBI Director Louis Free announced Potts' transfer to a position in the FBI's training division. Free says he doesn't believe Potts can do his job effectively because of the controversy. The standoff with white supremacist Randy Weaver resulted in the shooting deaths of Weaver's wife and son. Just this week, an FBI official was suspended for allegedly destroying a document that contradicted Potts' version of the incident. President Clinton visited workers at the CIA today. He noted that agency has come under tough criticism recently, and he thanked them for their hard work. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
Mr. Clinton's trip to CIA headquarters included a wreath-laying ceremony to honor those who lost their lives in the line of duty, the presentation of the National Security Medal to former Acting Director Admiral William Studeman, and some compliments for the agency's employees.
I am here today first and foremost to thank you and your families for the work and sacrifices you have made for the security of the United States of America.
Mr. Clinton specifically reassured CIA employees over the Aldrich Ames spy case, saying changes need to be made, but insisting that the Ames case is a terrible exception to a proud tradition of service. Bill Small at the White House.
The Irish government and Catholic leaders from Northern Ireland are expressing their concerns to the British government over the slow pace of the peace process. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
Irish Prime Minister John Bruton and Northern Ireland's Catholic political leaders John Hume and Gerry Adams discussed the lack of progress in the peace process. The British government has refused to convene all-party talks until the IRA decommissions its weapons. The Irish government says talks should begin without preconditions. So far, there has been no movement on the British side, and there is growing fear that the process is beginning to unravel. Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams, in an article published today, said British intransigence over IRA arms was forcing politics back onto the streets of Northern Ireland. Catholic demonstrators threw firebombs at police in Belfast last night. After their meeting, Bruton, Hume, and Adams issued a statement calling for all-party talks to begin as soon as possible. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Bosnian Serbs are ordering civilians and Bosnian government troops out of another safe area, the town of Zepa. The demand comes as the United Nations struggles to feed thousands of Muslims driven out of the former safe city of Srebrenica. The Serbs captured it earlier this week. NATO jets flew over Zepa today, 2 hours after the Serbian ultimatum expired. The Serbs had shelled 3 UN posts. On Wall Street, stocks fell today. The Dow dropped 18.5 points to end the day at 4,708. This is NPR. Questions are surfacing about Russian President Boris Yeltsin's health. He's canceled all appointments for several days. He remains hospitalized in Moscow, where he's being monitored for heart problems. Paul Brandis reports from Moscow.
Yeltsin's appointments have now been canceled through July 24th, and Kremlin sources tell the Interfax news agency that the president will probably stay in Moscow's Central Clinical Hospital another week. Yeltsin was rushed to the hospital Tuesday complaining of chest pains. Doctors said the 64-year-old president has angina, which means his heart hasn't been getting enough blood. Yeltsin was scheduled to visit Norway next week, but Kremlin spokesman Sergei Medvedev says doctors think the airplane trip would be too stressful. Meanwhile, the president continues to work out of his hospital suite. He issued an order today setting a December date for elections to Russia's lower house of parliament. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Brandis in Moscow.
Japanese authorities have released revised death toll figures from the January earthquake. They say more than 6,000 people died in the tremor. Officials from the region say 553 more people have been added to the dead. Some 24,000 people are still homeless. Israeli and PLO negotiators have ended their final round of talks on expanding Palestinian self-rule. They do plan another day on Sunday. They're meeting at a resort in northern Israel. They've got 11 days to go before their deadline to reach agreement on Palestinian elections and Israeli troop withdrawal from the West Bank. Researchers are reporting some progress in the effort to protect the Earth's ozone layer. The journal Science says atmospheric measures show a decline in the industrial chemical methyl chloroform. It's been linked to ozone layer depletion. Researchers say its concentration in the atmosphere has fallen about 2% every year since 1991. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
I'm Terry Gross, and on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring interviews with the hosts of All Things Considered. Noah Adams became the host of the weekend edition in 1978, started hosting the weekday edition in 1982. He left the program in 1988 to host Minnesota Public Radio's Good Evening and returned to All Things Considered in 1989. I spoke with Noah Adams in 1992 after the publication of his book, Noah Adams on All Things Considered, a Radio Journal. You write that at workshops, you always ask, how many of you are happy with the way you sound? Are you happy with the way you sound?
Oh, gosh, no. I don't think people outside the business really understand this. I have only worked with one person who really liked his voice, and he was in broadcasting for just a few years, and he was just enthralled by the way he sounded, and he was lost. He couldn't do much. This is the truth. I leave the studio here, and when I don't ride my bike home, if it's raining or something, I will take a cab after the program. And I will get into a taxi cab, and likely as not now, maybe a third of the time, All Things Considered will be on the radio. The cabbie's listening to our program on a later feed from one of the stations here in Washington. And I find, what am I going to do? I find it so painful to hear myself that I'll cover up my ears or ask him to turn it off and then have to explain the whole thing. So what I wind up doing is sort of whistling to myself. And at the same time, I'm proud of it. So a couple of times I have said, hey, that's me there on the radio. And they say, oh, yeah, well, you know, it's like, well, somebody's got to be on the radio. I just don't like the way I sound. I don't think most people do. And my attitude is, if they bring you a paycheck every Friday, then don't worry about it.
What reaction do you typically get from listeners who know you only through your voice and suddenly they see the body?
It's invariably disappointment, and I'm prepared for that. And I try to make them, because they're embarrassed, I then try to make them feel better about the fact that they are disappointed. And I try to make a joke. I'm 5'5", and they have whatever it is. I mean, I could look like Robert Redford, or let's say Brad Pitt, because he looks like the young Robert Redford in this new movie, A River Runs Through It. I could look like Brad Pitt, and they would be disappointed because people, I mean, the wonder, the metaphysical wonder of radio is that people have this idea of what you sound like, and you really shouldn't go out in public and dispel that, I think. I mean, I think it's better that, I think the magic happens on radio. And it's probably not a good idea to be running around out in the country too much, I think.
No, in your book you write, I've always had a difficult time starting a conversation with a stranger, and I can never quite understand how I ended up doing it for a living. What makes it easier to approach somebody with a microphone in your hand than to go up to them at, say, a party or on the street or whatever and talk?
Well, you have an excuse, so you have a reason for being there, and for me personally, it allows me to do it, and it's a very businesslike thing. And I can also find that I'm focused a lot more, and so if I'm nervous, it doesn't really show, and it's not really a problem anymore. I used to go out to do interviews on stories, and really would pray that the person I was going to go see wasn't there, and I would be able to come back to the studio and say, "Well, the guy has stood me up; he wasn't there," and. But it does seem to work out. I like to work with producers because they will go do that. They will, as I say, go up to people, and I'll talk to them. I hate to be so shy, but on the other hand, I feel that it does focus me, and I do pay more attention, and it probably does work okay, and people shouldn't worry about the fact that they're shy if they want to work in radio. Sometimes it gets really to be a problem, and I used to worry about it a lot more than I do now, and now I'm getting better, and I can walk right up to somebody and say, you know, I'm doing a radio story. Would you mind talking to me?
When was it a problem?
At the very beginning.
So what went wrong when it was a problem?
Well, I would just sort of stammer and stutter, and I wouldn't have the courage of my convictions. I recall talking to, and I still have that problem sometimes with interviews. I'll just tell you a quick story. I recall talking to Dr. Edward Teller. some years ago doing a story about Star Wars, and we'd traveled. It was a long story. We'd done a lot of traveling. I'd read about 10, 13 books. I knew exactly what I was talking about. He was the last interview, and we went to his office at Stanford, and I let Dr. Teller totally intimidate me. I just let him run completely over me, mostly because he was a key figure in this thing. He recommended it to the Reagan administration, the Strategic Defense Initiative. And his opinion was very, very valuable. I think he's a fascinating guy. Well, he was very mean to me. He said to me, for example, what is the long... I wish I could do his accent, but I won't insult him by trying to do it. What is the longest... This is a very sophisticated question. What is the longest unedited answer you will use on the radio? And I said, oh, I don't know, 40 seconds. And he said, fine, ask me a question. I asked him a question. He said, no, that's a stupid question. Ask me this question. That's a stupid question. Ask me this. How was it that you thought to suggest this idea to President Reagan in the White House in the Oval Office? Anyway, like that. And he said, fine. And he had his own stopwatch on his wrist, and he started his answer and started the watch and finished at 39 seconds and said, see there, now you owe me 1 second. He said, you will not edit that answer. And I felt bad over the years that I didn't tell him exactly what I thought of that situation, hoping, and not just to be vindictive, but hoping to provoke him into a real conversation about the issue. As it turned out, we had hardly anything. We just had to put what he said right on the air, and it really wasn't a good dialogue.
It's amazing when people think they're really doing themselves a service by thinking they're outsmarting you when really they're sabotaging themselves.
Yeah. Well, he may have been hurt badly, misquoted in the past.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was.
My guest is Noah Adams. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Noah Adams, a host of All Things Considered. I asked him if he had any ground rules for interviewing and if he tells the person he's interviewing what to expect.
No, I don't think so. I always will tell them that we are recording the interview at the moment we start, and that can be a bit disarming because they will you can be having a nice conversation on the satellite circuit or a telephone circuit or even here in the studio. And they're just talking to you, and they're having a great deal of fun. And then if you say, okay, now we're going to start to record, they say, oh, okay, well, ask me a question, and I'll give you an answer. I sort of tighten up. But no, I don't. I sort of have some rules of my own, but I don't tell people about that. I'm thinking.
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I'm thinking about, I don't pry very much. I want people to answer the question, to be honest, about answering the question, to give me a direct answer. And to that end, I'm going to do almost anything I have to do. I recall asking somebody who was a Klan leader one time why they hated black people. And it was an astounding question to this man. He was sitting in our studio with two bodyguards. And I was determined I was going to get some sort of answer to that, or at least 2 minutes of his trying to answer it that would be pretty evident.
Was he able to explain to you why he hated black people?
No, he had never been asked that question before. It was the conceit that's not what was on his mind, or that's not what drives him in the organization, and he was shocked by the question. He really was.
Oh, but by the assumption that he hated black
right,
people,
right? Yeah.
Well, that must have really thrown you, though. I mean, how do you get? Then you have to kind of get beyond the surface of what somebody tells you they're about and try to get beneath to what you suspect they really are about, and they're going to fight you on it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it happens. I think that all interviews should be basically adversarial in nature, which is to say that I think that if somebody has one strong side of a position, that the interview should come from the other side. Tomorrow you may do one totally on the other side of another issue, but I think that all interviews should just be a little bit tense, and I'm probably not, you know, I could name 10 better interviewers in public radio than I am. I'm a bit too romantic You know, I think everybody's great. I have to remind myself to be cynical. I wish I'd gone to law school. I think law school would be great training for journalism because, you tend to look at both sides and to try to figure out if somebody's telling the truth.
So you believe that the interview should be adversarial, but on the other hand, you admire a lot of the people you interview and yeah. You don't do the adversarial interview.
Yeah, well, sure. I've just come back. I know I've come back, especially with old men. I will just go out and make a fool out of myself with old men and old women, and I would just, make saints of them on the radio if editors would let me do that. And the editor will say to me, well, why didn't you ask this or this? And it just never occurs to me sometime because I like them so much. You know, old people who have accomplished something. And I'll go talk to them and I just think it's great what they're doing. And there'll be these shadowy aspects of their past that I never get into. So I have to watch that.
Are you ever alarmed by what you find out about a person after the interview? I mean, it's happened to me that I've interviewed somebody who struck me as a very sensitive poet. Then a week later, I talk to someone who happens to have been their student. They say, oh, by the way, do you know that he slept with a lot of his students?
And mm-hmm.
It's like, no, that wasn't in our interview. I did not know that.
Yeah.
And you feel like, well, you've given this really sensitive portrayal of somebody, and it's false.
That's what I meant by being overly romantic. That happens to me quite a bit. In fact, I had this happen. I guess we've all been fooled now. I don't know about you, but many of us here at NPR have been fooled by interviews. There was a story a few years back about a florist down in Charleston, West Virginia, who had been persecuted in his community because it was known he had AIDS. I called this man and did the interview, and, oh, it was heartbreaking. He told about going into the supermarket and having people turn the other way with their carts and run away and having a woman drive up to his flower shop and throw a check. She owed him money through the front door. They shunned him in this community. It was just a wrenching interview. It turned out to be a complete hoax. I don't know what was going on with this fella.
How'd you find out?
Well, we had checked it out a bit, and the state attorney general in West Virginia had made a statement. So we put the story on the air. And then 2 weeks later or three, the state attorney general said, well, this man's telling a lie, and we've all been fooled. And I've always felt so bad about that because we didn't make one phone call, not one, into this man's community down there near Charleston to say, do you know this guy? Is he telling the truth? Is the community shunning him? We didn't. And we got a letter, and it said, you have insulted everybody in the state of West Virginia. And I think that the letter writer was right. You know, I think we made a terrible mistake like that.
Now, in your book, you say, and I really agree with you on this, that you find it more difficult to interview people who you know, and you prefer to interview people that you don't know. Can you explain that phenomenon? Because I usually experience the same thing.
I don't know what that's about. I don't know how that works. Maybe it is that I'm just a bit too much relaxed, and maybe the things we're talking about are too well known between the two of us. I've gotten to know people who I've interviewed before and tried to interview them the second time, a second book, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it to be difficult. And a lot of times it hasn't worked. And a lot of times I will just say, well, you know, let's go on and find somebody else. Let's find the first novel from somebody else or a new book of poetry. You don't have to interview. Over the period of time that I've been here, I've talked to John McPhee 3 times. And, now I still love his writing, but now I'm trying to find somebody who would have been like John McPhee was in 1975. I don't want to say like a young John McPhee, but you know what I mean? I'm trying to find mm-hmm. somebody at that level because I'd rather just go have lunch with John McPhee and talk about what he's doing now than to try to do a radio interview with him.
You're out on assignment a lot. Say during the Gulf War they had said to you, Noah, we want to send you to the Middle East. We want to send you to Saudi Arabia. Would you have wanted to go?
Yeah. I wanted to go to the Persian Gulf War because, for one thing, it was a bit safer than some other places. I'll just tell you a quick story. I went to Romania right after the revolution, and John Hockenberry was dying to get there as soon as he could. In fact, got there very, very early. Came in on Monday, Christmas Day. That's the day that they executed the Ceausescus. And John called back to his editor here and said, tell those other guys to wait, it's not safe. I was one who was saying, you know, I've got a career and a reputation. I don't need to go in there. It's very dangerous. We thought that first weekend they were killing over 10,000 people. I was saying, let's wait, go in later. So I'm very cautious. I did want to go to the Persian Gulf War. These things pale, though, by comparison to what's going on in Yugoslavia. It could be 30 journalists who have been killed there. It's a desperate, desperate situation. I have so much admiration for people like John Burns of the New York Times and for Blaine Harden of the Washington Post, Tom Jelton of NPR, who's been in Sarajevo. It's an incredibly serious and difficult thing they're doing, and I would not want to go to Sarajevo at this point.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just want to say, I for 1 week, I think it was, I guest hosted All Things Considered, and so we worked together that week. And I remember in the studio, I would have all these questions about what happens next and what do I do. And there's times when I thought, well, we'll just like sit and schmooze while this story is on. And you were so intently listening to the show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just really clear to me that, you know, you wanted to know absolutely everything that happened on the program, and you felt very responsible for everything that happened on the program, whether it was your piece or not your piece. But you felt that listeners would hold you accountable, and you were holding yourself accountable.
Well, you know, the big bad thing about coming to Washington to work for All Things Considered is that you don't get to hear it unless you go home and then listen to it or come back the next day. So I want to be at least on a par with the listeners. I want to know what was on the program. And a lot of it's really practical, too. A lot of things will come in context that you need to refer back to. So I try to hear as much as I can.
Noah Adams is a host of All Things Considered. His next book, to be published in March, will be about the year he spent learning to play the piano. Our interview was recorded in 1992. More interviews from the archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on the latest developments in Bosnia?
Hi, Terry. We'll be covering the story from Washington and from Tuzla, where the refugees from Srebrenica have been taken. Mike O'Connor reports from Sarajevo about the intensified attack against Jepa, another UN safe area. Other stories, David Wellner reports in Mexico City on torture in Mexico. Human rights groups say that police are using torture as a way of investigating crime. I'll talk with Ching Li Wu, the wife of Harry Wu, the Chinese-American who is now imprisoned in China. Ira Glass has a story from Chicago about the heat. And we'll listen to some thunderstorms and hear how people feel about thunderstorm activity.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Is there a reason the adjective French is considered more sexy than the adjective American? Well, that's a question for our linguist, Jeff Nunberg.
The Australians have been put out of joint lately by Jacques Chirac's announcement that France would resume nuclear testing in the South Pacific. And the Australian sex industry wants to do its part. A trade association based in Canberra announced that the nation's sex shops and brothels will launch a boycott of French adult videos and sex products. They're also going to try to revise the vocabulary to rid it of terms that portray the French as lovers, which they describe as a peaceful image that's inconsistent with a nuclear test resumption. Sex shops say they will insist that customers ask for condoms rather than for French letters, as the Australians and the British call them. And the Trade Association says they'll be looking for new Australian names to replace phrases like French kiss. You think of those billboards for Foster's Ale, you know, the steak with a sprig of parsley and the words Australian for dinner salad, Australian for French tickler. I don't want to think about it. I wish them luck, but I doubt whether they'll have much success with the language part of their boycott. The fact is that the French have been taking the linguistic rap for all sorts of sexual license since at least the late 15th century. That was when the world was swept by the first great epidemic of syphilis, which the English called the French pox. Of course, at the time, everybody else was blaming syphilis on foreigners, too. The French called it the Neapolitan disease. The Neapolitans called it the French disease. The Dutch called it the Spanish pox. The Poles called it the German disease. And when it reached Tahiti a couple of centuries later, it was called the English disease. Still, it's no accident that the English blamed syphilis on the French. Even then, the English took the French as the model for lewd and dissolute customs. And the connection would have been that much stronger since it was widely believed that you could only contract a venereal disease through repeated indulgence in illicit sexual pleasures. They had some primitive notions back then. By the 18th century, the word French was being attached to a variety of sexual activities and appurtenances. In fact, the label had a certain patriotic ring, since it was popular to say that French customs and luxury goods were eroding the fiber of British society, particularly among the aristocracy. When you described a practice as French, you gave the impression that it was a sort of thing that decent Britons wouldn't have been able to think up on their own. This was a little disingenuous, of course, and by the end of the 18th century, the adjective French was becoming a general label for anything illicit or salacious, whether it actually originated in France or not. That's when people started saying, "Pardon my French," to excuse the utterance of words of unimpeachably Anglo-Saxon origin. And there was certainly no reason to refer to condoms as French letters. They were made in Britain and were almost certainly a British invention, a point the French themselves acknowledge when they refer to condoms as capotes anglaises, or English bonnets. By the way, it isn't at all clear why they're called letters. Some people say it's from an association of letters with envelopes, but actually, modern envelopes weren't much used until the late 19th century. And anyway, if that's what they meant, why didn't they just say French envelopes in the first place? In any event, by modern times, the adjective French has come to have very little to do with the French. Or rather, it has little to do with the real French, the people who drive around in Peugeots and vote for Jacques Chirac and probably kiss with their mouths closed, for all we know. It's about those other Frenchmen, the mustache-twirling roué and the rouged coquette who lurk deep in the psyche of every Anglophone and whisper indecent propositions into our ears. I always figured that that's what Thomas Jefferson had in mind when he said that every man had two countries, his own and France. And that's the problem facing the folks in Canberra who want to get rid of all this vocabulary. It's sort of hard to imagine anybody saying this sort of thing about Australia.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. We expected to end today's show with our film critic Stephen Schiff's review of 9 Months. But instead of reviewing this comedy about a man who is dragged kicking and screaming into fatherhood, Stephen became a father. We congratulate him and his wife Rebecca, and we welcome their daughter Allegra Madison Schiff. We hope she's the kind of baby who knows how to respect a father's deadlines. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of New Passages, Mapping Your Life Across Time, the new book from Gail Sheehy, author of Passages. This is NPR, National Public Radio.